Case number 07-5383, United States of America versus $6,976,934.65 plus interest deposited into Royal Bank of Scotland International, account number 2029-56141070, held in the name of Solberry Limited and property traceable thereto, Solberry Limited appellant. Mr. Sherbet for the appellant, Mr. Stapleton for the appellee.
May it please the court, Juan Chartier for Solberry, the appellant. Your Honor, I would like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
Your Honor, I represent Solberry, and this is a case about the government overreaching. This is a case about the federal court not exercising its discretionary ability in this case and looking at what I think is most important, the threshold issue of whether the government or the case that the government filed had proper jurisdiction in a court in the District of Columbia. The judge in that case looked at, sort of like took the case and switched it around, and he decided as a threshold issue whether the fugitive disentitlement statute applied. And what we're saying is because that statute is akin to a criminal statute, it should be strictly construed against the government. In other words, the government has to have the burden of showing that what they did was right. So what we thought...
It's not a criminal statute, though, right? You said
it's not a criminal statute,
it's
but it's akin. Correct. And I cited a Supreme Court case where it says that fugitive disentitlement statutes in general should be governed by what's called the rule of lenity, which should be strictly construed against the government because they're taking something of value, in this case, property worth $7 million. So the statute clearly gives the judge discretion, okay? It says it in there. And the discretion should have been, let's look at what the government has done. Let's look at the defenses, because remember, we came as a defendant. We didn't use or try to tax the courts by being a petitioner and saying, you need to do this. No, 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 no. We were brought in the case, and as part of our affirmative defenses, which we had 12, two of them were jurisdiction, and the second was failure to state a claim. And what we're saying is that the judge should have looked at the jurisdiction that, in my opinion, Law School 101 civil procedure is the first thing that you need to look at to see, is this case here? Should it be here? And if not, why? He didn't give us that opportunity. The government did whatever it could not to give us the opportunity to argue. They moved to stay the proceeding for literally 2 years, Your Honors, 2 years, while they went and got what they call an indictment, but let's not get into the merits. They did get an indictment 2 years after the fact and didn't give us the opportunity to essentially look at the complaint and point out to the court why or why it was not defective. We say it was defective in many instances. On the issue of did the court over its discretion, did it do something that it shouldn't have done? Yes. We believe that the court did not give us the opportunity to argue our case. And I think from a threshold issue, that's what it should have done. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
No, I want to ask you a question. You talk about a question of jurisdiction.
Yes, sir.
But my recollection was your brief talked only of venue, and as I go back to the table of contents, that's what you speak of. Venue is not jurisdiction. Venue is waivable, and I don't see why a waiver can't take place by becoming a fugitive just as well as by any other method of waiver.
Well, the whole basis for the indictment, the whole basis for the complaint was that they said that the District of Columbia had venue.
But you're, just to make sure, that defense is venue, not jurisdiction.
Correct. Okay. Correct, Your Honor. And we're saying that there was no venue in the District of Columbia because all the acts related to an offshore banking account on the island of Guernsey.
Okay, and so how's that different, other than being preliminary in some sense, different from any other defense that the statute, if it applies, would bar.
Because we weren't allowed to argue that. This is what this.
Well, that's the effect of such a statute, right?
No, not this statute.
Prevents you from posing defenses that otherwise you could pose.
But it may please the court. The whole point of being able to argue whether the complaint was valid or not was our ability to argue that the venue was not correct, and the Fugitive Disentitlement Act allows the court the discretion to hear that argument, and we weren't allowed to raise the argument. That's the point here, Your Honors.
Assume we disagree with you on that. Under the statute, you're effectively barred if you're a fugitive. What else are you here about? What are your principal claims? You can't walk away now and say, I'm going to sit and listen to the other side and then I'll come back. You need to tell us. You're the appellant.
Right.
What do you have?
Okay. Well, let's talk about the due process argument. You have the Fifth Amendment. You have the Eighth Amendment.
You tell us precisely where you want to go. I mean, this is a new statute. There's not a lot of precedent. Your responsibility to point us rather specifically and precisely to what it is in this case that you think should cause us to award in your favor, to rule in your favor, with precision.
Sure. Okay. Before this statute was passed, the Supreme Court in Dagan had essentially ruled that the government has to have some checks and balances, because if they're going to take stuff, which is what they were doing, seizures, they have to jump through some hoops. Congress then passed the Fugitive Disentitlement Act, which was discretion. It gave the courts, the underlying courts, the discretion to look to see if what the government did was okay. What we're saying is it's in the statute. The language is in there. The government has to go through a bunch of hoops. They have to do a warrant. They have to do an indictment. There has to be notice. There's a bunch of stuff that I went through precisely in my brief, and that's a factual matter. What we're saying is, based on that, the court should have looked at the whole picture. When we filed our answer, we filed 12 affirmative defenses. And from the get-go, what the judge says, I'm not even going to look at your defenses because I'm going to decide the threshold issue of whether your client is a fugitive. And I'm saying that's putting like the horse before the cart, et cetera, et cetera. We weren't allowed, Your Honor, to take what's in the statute, in other words, the steps that the government had to do to declare us a fugitive. We weren't even allowed to address that. The court on the papers, we weren't even allowed to have a hearing. We weren't allowed to do anything. The court just decided, and I'm quoting, as a threshold issue, I decide that Solberry is a fugitive, therefore, Mr. Chartier, you can't argue anything else. The government then moved for summary judgment, and that's how they got the money. So what we're saying is that we should have been given the opportunity, at least under the Fifth Amendment, due process clause.
Let me direct your language to the statute. As I understand it, we're here looking at 28 U.S.C. 2466. Help me understand your argument that Mr. Scott, in order to avoid criminal prosecution, did not decline, that the reason he declined to reenter the United States was not in order to avoid criminal prosecution.
Right. Your Honor, Mr. Scott, as the record shows and as the government has argued, left the country in 92. Okay,
Is there anything in the record on his travel pattern?
Yes.
Thereafter?
Yes. Well, travel pattern, no, but the government concedes that he didn't elect to come back to the States, not because of the indictment, but because he made his residence in Antigua. The government states that the record shows that he became a resident and a citizen of Antigua much before the indictments, and that after the indictment came down, he renounced U.S. citizen. There was no record of Mr. Scott ever being a fugitive, as the name entitles. He just left the country in 92 and never came back.
We got the television interview where he acknowledges that if he returns to the United States, he's going to be arrested.
Well,
you're not claiming he didn't know about these criminal proceedings, are you?
He knew about the 98 criminal complaint in New York.
Okay.
That was the basis of the
interview. What about the 2005?
He did not know.
But his counsel for Solbury received a copy of the of the indictment, right?
Correct. And so that was not me.
He didn't know about that?
That's not the...
He's the majority shareholder of Solbury.
Whether he did or not, Your Honor...
No, did he? I'm asking you, did he know that?
I don't know, because I wasn't his counsel. Mr. Summers was his counsel. But to answer your question forthrightly, he probably did know.
Okay. So he didn't come back from the 98 in order to avoid prosecution, right? He knew about, he knew the 98 was out there.
Criminal complaint, right, which never went into an indictment, and no warrant was
ever... So what's the standard we're supposed to look at with respect to the 2005, when the language of the statute says, in order to avoid criminal prosecution? What does the government have to show there, that, to show that that his failure to come back into the United States was in order to avoid criminal prosecution? Yes, what do they have to show?
Well, they have to show several things, that a warrant was issued. And our contention is that even the letter that Your Honor refers to from the government to Mr. Summer talks about the indictment, doesn't talk about a warrant. Okay? And the statute clearly says that the other side has to be aware of a warrant. I don't think that if you look at the letter, which is the last exhibit in the government's appendix, it says that. So the government was never able to show that Mr. Scott and Solbury were aware that a warrant issued on the 2002-2003 indictment. On the 98, there's a five-year statute of limitations on that. There was no indictment, so that case is a red herring. That's gone. Plus, Solbury was never a party to that criminal complaint in 98. It was Mr. Scott, and we're talking about Wire Act violations, and this case is about internet gaming, which are different. If you look at the Fifth Circuit case in N. Ray MasterCard, it's clear that the only circuit that's ruled on this has ruled that the Wire Act doesn't apply to internet gaming. Government cited an unpublished district court decision in Utah, okay, which is unpublished, yet they cited it anyway, saying that it is. I'm saying that the only circuit that's ever weighed in on this, and it's still standing, the Fifth Circuit out of New Orleans, says internet gaming is not covered under the Wire Act. And in fact, let's look at what Congress did a year ago, the passage of the Unlawful Internet Gaming Enforcement Act. It was an attempt to try to correct the misinterpretation of the Wire Act, because then what they did is they made all forms of gambling, at least the financial aspects of them, covered. Still didn't amend the Wire Act. It just sort of gave the government another tool. Again, this was in response to cases like this, where people are arguing that the Wire Act didn't cover. So what does that mean? If the Wire Act didn't cover, then Mr. Scott's or Solbury's activity was not illegal, Your Honor. And therefore, their indictment, the money laundering, what's the predicate act? There was not anything illegal. But again, we were not given the opportunity to go on the merits. That's the second argument we had, that that the government's complaint was deficient, and therefore they didn't have a case, and that therefore we wanted to dismiss the case on failure to state a claim. Again, the court didn't give us the opportunity to discuss that, because preliminarily, as a threshold issue, decided Solbury was a fugitive. Your Honor, I'd like to reserve my 2 minutes and 45 seconds left.
Okay.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Rob Stapleton, and I represent the United States of America. There are three issues that we're here to discuss today.
Could you help me to understand what the phrase "in order to avoid criminal prosecution" means in the statute?
Yes, Your Honor. I think
it sure sounds like it means the government has to show some specific intent, that there's some burden on you to show that the reason he didn't return was to avoid criminal prosecution.
Yes, Your Honor. But as district court pointed out, and as precedents pointed out from other courts, including the Second Circuit and
that's not precedent.
Well, not precedent. Excuse me, Your Honor. But other courts have pointed out, like the Second Circuit and the district court in Alabama, you can do so via totality of the circumstances.
Totality of the circumstances, great. But
what's in it?
Proving what? Right. There's got to be a standard that the circumstances meet.
Well, Your Honor,
standard. It sounds, as Judge Griffith said, like specific intent to not return because of warrant or process.
I don't know that it's necessarily specific intent. What we have here is when you look at this, because in part you have to take the full construction of the statute here into account. Part of it is also otherwise evades the jurisdiction and or that the defendant declines to enter or re-enter as the defendant did in Colossos and as the defendant had, or the claimant, excuse me, did in Colossos.
Evade, at least to my mind, is a verb that certainly conjures up a purpose. I don't know how you can evade something accidentally or for reasons other than trying to evade what it is you're accused of evading.
Your Honor, but it's also enter or re-enter. We have to look at it.
Well, you still have to show the purpose.
Declines to enter or re-enter.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, that's a purpose.
Right. And but again, when the district court below, Chief Judge Lamberth, when he looked at everything.
This is de novo review, is it not?
Yes, for the applicability of 24.
Right. So it doesn't matter what Judge Lamberth looked at.
Yes, Your Honor. But what we're looking at here is you have an instance in which the claimant is a shell corporation for Mr. Scott, and that he was using that corporation to engage in online wagering and betting. When the 1998 criminal complaint came out, an arrest warrant was issued, as we noted in the complaint to initiate the civil forfeiture case, as well as the fact that we mailed that to Mr. Scott at two separate addresses, one in Antigua, one in the United States, mailed it to a copy of it to accountants and to a lawyer who we thought was representing him at the time, which is all in the record in the district court.
It sounds to me as if you're arguing that awareness, put aside the question of that not being the warrant or process that's relevant here, but you appear to be arguing that awareness of the warrant or process plus non-return is enough. So now that would cover someone who had lived abroad, perhaps in the same place, for 20 years, right? Mm-hmm. His failure to hop on a plane to come back shows that he didn't re-enter in order to avoid the process.
Your Honor,
which is linguistically nonsensical.
Well, I'm building up to it, Your Honor. In addition to the notice of the claim, you also have this interview in 2001 with Mr. Scott by the Canadian Broadcasting Company's corporation show, The Fifth Estate, where he acknowledged that there was someone told him, the interviewer in that interview told him there was an arrest warrant out for him. Now,
okay, that's awareness.
That's certainly
and that's
awareness.
That's 98, and you've got some serious statute of limitations problems on 98. Get to 2005.
Yes, Your Honor. In 2005, the indictment came out. In fact, the grand jury was opened prior to the filing of the civil forfeiture complaint. We, as the complaint went on and as the grand jury went on, we asked to stay, which is appropriate according to the statute, and we went to Judge Lamberth at the time, and we actually had a number of status reports and status conferences with Judge Lamberth to show that the cases were related and that the district court, the grand jury investigation could impact the criminal or the forfeiture complaint and vice versa.
But what do you have to show that Mr. Scott did not re-enter the United States after the 2005 indictment in order to avoid criminal prosecution? That's what you have to show. So
yes,
what do you have to show that?
Well, you have, granted, we unsealed the indictment the day before our filing, but the case went on for 10 months, and Judge Lamberth did not issue an opinion in the case until March of 2000.
No question, he could have come back, but
right.
That's not my question. My question is, what evidence do you have to show that he didn't come back in order to avoid the criminal prosecution? That's the language of the statute.
Again, Your Honor, even if 1998 clearly applies, he's a fugitive from the 1998 complaint and the arrest warrant. He's
I'm
a fugitive.
Let's assume that.
Yeah, I'm with you.
And that's all that we actually really need to show that he's a fugitive.
If you lose the 98 on statute of limitations, you better have something on 2005 for me. So.
I understand, Your Honor, okay. But we don't lose the case on the statute of limitations in 1998 because the statute's told while he's a fugitive. He knows.
Well, there might be a genuine issue, a material fact that precludes summary judgment. I'm saying for me, give me the 2005.
Sure. We've noticed his attorneys. We made the attorneys in this case, and there is no mistake in
You're
that.
You're communicating the fact of awareness. I think that's accepted. Nobody denies awareness. Question is how you get from awareness and non-return to non-return with intent to avoid.
I think, Your Honors,
that... It could show a travel pattern. I mean, if he was coming back and forth to the United States frequently before, I would say, the pertinent indictment, then that would be evidence. But you don't appear to have that.
Well, I think part of it, too, is, Your Honor, is that he did, Scott, that is, an attempt to otherwise evade, arguably, as Judge Lamberth noted in his opinion, that he gave up his U.S. citizenship.
So which way does that cut?
Well, I think it cuts to the fact that he's trying to not have, he's trying to limit access to him by the United States law enforcement community. Because he's in Antigua, a country where we cannot extradite him from for this, because in Antigua, online gaming is not against the law.
Can you extradite him from Antigua if he is a citizen, but not if he isn't?
No, Your Honor, I don't think Antigua...
So it has no bearing on the question of extradition.
But I think it does go to his mindset, which is what you're inquiring about here.
Well,
and his mindset is to try to make it as difficult as possible for the United States to get his hands.
I tried to find out how it made it more difficult. You turn to the question of extradition, then it turns out it doesn't make any difference, at least as your understanding is, doesn't make any difference on extradition.
But it goes to his intent, Your Honor.
It goes to his intent if there's some connection between the renunciation and the reach of the United States, as far as I can see.
But in his, it doesn't matter what the, in this instance, him giving up that his United States citizenship and taking on Antiguan citizenship goes to his mindset. In reality, it might be that it has no impact.
What is it? If it's plain to everybody that renunciation of citizenship increases one's invulnerability to extradition, then I would understand your point. Absent that, I don't understand your point.
Well, most countries in extradition will not extradite their own citizens, which he is now a citizen of Antigua and not of the United States. But really what we're looking at is his mindset. And if
we can only make inferences about his mindset in the light of some understanding of the applicable rules.
Right. We can only make those inferences, Your Honor, because Mr. Scott will not present himself to answer these questions. We've made numerous attempts to, through his attorneys, to ask him to come to the United States. In fact, in one of our motions, we even offered to withdraw the 2466 were he to come to the United States and answer to a deposition. We also, in the same reply motion, we noted that we wanted to know who was paying the lawyers who were representing him. And Mr. Chartier was...
Passports have to be shown when coming into the United States from Antigua?
They think they do now, Your Honor.
And aren't all passports, all people presenting a passport at any airport or port, isn't that recorded electronically showing that they came in?
I think so, Your Honor.
And so it's pretty easy for the government to get at least that, which would seem to be the critical aspect of his travel pattern.
It's possible, Your Honor. I'm not exactly sure when or how United States citizens had to show a passport or Antiguan citizens had to show a passport coming into the United States from Antigua. I know there are recent changes in passport law in the United States, so I'd have to look at that exactly. But I think getting back to your question, it's his intent and it's his mindset. And if he's giving up U.S. citizenship to make it more difficult because in his mind he thinks that, then
What's the evidence that he thinks that?
Well, Your Honor, he knows about the warrant. He knew at the time that he gave that up about the warrant of his arrest for the 1998 complaint.
You're still making the leap. You're really saying anything he does to stay abroad shows that he was staying abroad in order to defeat the warrant or process against him.
But I don't think that Your Honor, I think when you're examining when you're looking at the law and you're looking at the totality of the circumstances,
yes,
in this case, it's not he would come back but for.
How do we know? That's the question.
Well, we can't know because we can't read his mind and he won't present himself to the court. And this is the very intent of the statute itself.
You're saying there's a presumption that if he doesn't come back, it must be because he wanted to avoid the warrant or process unless he can meet the burden of showing otherwise.
In a way, yes, Your Honor, because there are exceptions for the application
what
of
is,
this law.
You said that's the very intent of the statute. What did you mean by that? What's the intent of the statute?
The intent of the statute is to get at the people who will not come to the United States as much for the people who...
But that's not what the language of the statute says. It's to get at people who will not reenter the United States in order to avoid criminal prosecution. It's not getting at everyone who won't come to the United States, right?
No, it's not to get everybody that won't come to the
United States. So what does that phrase mean?
It means
to me your argument wants to take that phrase out of the statute, and I don't think we're allowed to do that.
No, Your Honor. What we're saying is that when you look at the totality of the circumstances, when you look at everything, his knowledge of the warrants, the fact, the shell corporations, that
we... How do the shell corporate? I mean, that shows, it's correct, maybe he's manipulating things. So what?
Well, he's manipulating things to hide from the United States government his illegal proceeds, much in the way that he's trying to hide from the United States law enforcement by taking umbrage in a small, tiny island nation that allows him to do what he wants to do.
Play out the 98 in connection with the statute. I'll make sure I'm trying to understand your argument. Is your argument that, is the warrant still good? Is that your argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
So now, under the statute, you're saying what? Because the warrant is still good, we don't have to worry about whether there was an ensuing indictment, prosecution, whatever. Is that your argument?
Yes, Your Honor. All we have to do is show one instance that he is a fugitive from a related case. 1998 is a related case. The warrant is still good because he knew about it. He declined to re-enter the United States to face up to those charges, and therefore that tolls the statute of limitations.
But you have to have an order to avoid criminal prosecution, right? So the warrant may be good, but there was no prosecution that resulted therefrom. I'm trying to understand how you're tying this up. You're saying that because 05 and 98 are related? What?
Yes, 05 and 98 are related, but because he's a fugitive from the 98, he's also a fugitive from 2005.
The 98 warrant.
Warrant.
Which is still good, you say?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, go ahead.
Because of that, and then again, take into his account Scott's interview with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, where he said that people like me under similar restrictions want to go back.
I understand you're trying to use the interview and everything else relating to the 98 warrant to show that with respect to that,
yes,
meet the statutory factors. What about in order to avoid criminal prosecution?
Well, that's the point of it, Your Honor. They're under similar restrictions, and they want to go back. But for me, that's fine. I don't want to go back. And if I wanted to go back, I wouldn't anyway, because there's a warrant out for my arrest, and I don't need to go back. And it's just that there's a warrant out there as well. I think if we the narrowing, if you get too narrow, you do away with the very intent of the Fugitive Disentitlement Statute as it is.
The district court didn't rely on that interview. You're saying because of summary judgment, we can look at the entire record?
I think that the district court took that into account, unless I'm mistaken.
He certainly didn't do it explicitly.
But it was again, the totality of the circumstances.
Now that doesn't tell us anything. I mean, well, you folks like to use that. The government loves to use that when you can't think of anything else. I don't know what you're talking about, the totality of the circumstances. We're looking to specific records, yes, that's before us. District court, as far as I can tell, did not rely on that. It's kind of perplexing. But is your argument, so what, it's a summary judgment? You're doing this de novo, you can look at the entire record?
That is part of it, Your Honor, but there's also the fact that the court took into account the media coverage that this received in Antigua, which
That's
was...
notice. That gives notice.
Agreed, Your Honor, but again, it shows his intent.
The interview is your best evidence, I guess. Yes?
I think so, yes, Your Honor.
Well, it's your case, yes or no.
Well, that's part of, I mean, it is because in...
Well, you tell me what's your best evidence.
Our best evidence...
intention to avoid criminal prosecution.
Clearly, that is our best evidence. He's saying that he doesn't want to come back to the United States because of the restrictions.
No, that is actually, I'm just looking at your brief, page 15.
Yes, sir.
Scott says, I don't mind not going back to the States. There are a few of us that are under the same restrictions that would like to go back to the States. Myself, that's fine. He seems to be saying he doesn't care about going back to the United States. It's not as if the warrant were... or what was holding him back, it's indifference to the United States.
Your Honor, he at the district court level lost $7 million, and that wasn't enough to entice him to come back to the United States.
He didn't lose it yet.
Well, at the district, agreed, Your Honor, but at the district court level, I'm saying...
Stop it a little bit, aren't we?
Sorry, Your Honor. But at the district court ruled in our favor, and that still did not entice him to come back
The district court didn't rule in your favor before this Canadian Broadcasting Company interview, right?
Certainly it did not, Your Honor. But
okay, so you're saying your key point of evidence is what he said in the interview. So you could jump ahead to all these other interesting things. Question is, what are the inferences to be drawn from that? It seems to me that he draws a sharp distinction between those who would like to go back to the States and himself. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's phony, I don't know, but if that's your best evidence, it doesn't seem to me it shows intent to avoid criminal prosecution.
But it may be one of our best pieces of evidence, but it also, again, Your Honor, the fact that he will not come back to the United States to defend himself in this action shows intent to evade.
You just take the "in order to" phrase out of the statute completely.
Well, he's declined to enter or reenter to face these charges, the United States charges, or to come forward and contest the civil forfeiture. He's trying to do it through proxy.
How can you help us understand this statute in a way that would not have us asking these questions about what was in his mind? Is there some way that you can make sense of this statute and have us not focus on what his purpose was in staying in Antigua?
Yes, Your Honor. The way the statute came about was a court ordered. Created by the courts, but then the Congress came in after the Deegan statute, when the Supreme Court gave it the opening, to say, we'll codify this. And then in the legislative history, we have that the intent of the statute is that when they're outside the jurisdiction of the court and they're using the United States financial system and economic system to benefit them in their illegal endeavors, there has to be a way to entice them to come back in. And this is that case. This is that case where we have an individual who's...
So the legislative history trumps the statutory language.
No, Your Honor.
What you just said does not explain "in order to" at all. It's simply in contradiction of the "in order to" language.
What the statute tries to get at is that you have an individual like Scott sitting elsewhere and using the resources of the United States system, at the same time trying to hide from one court while using another court to protect those interests, exactly as Scott is doing in this instance.
You know, I think we understand all that, but again, I'm trying to figure out some way to read this statute so that the phrase "in order to avoid criminal prosecution" can have me asking questions other than the ones I've been asking, and that is, what is there in the evidence to show that he stayed in Antigua in order to avoid criminal prosecution? And it appears to mean what it says, unless you can help me understand, you know, from the structure of the statute. I'm really not interested in legislative history, but is there something about the structure of the statute, other provisions of the statute, that would lead me to think it means something different than what, at least on first appearance,
Again, Your Honor, I get back to the fact that we cannot ask him these questions as much as we've tried. And the fact that we've tried and cannot get answers from the various attorneys.
It's these questions that I still don't know.
It's often true that the government can't extract from the defendant the evidence it would like to have.
No, you're absolutely not, Your Honor. But in this case, in a civil forfeiture case, if he claimed the Fifth Amendment, if he were to actually come to the United States and claim the Fifth Amendment, we'd be able to, in that case, we can get a rebuttable presumption in favor of the government.
Does the statute mean that we have to ask the question, why did he not come back to the United States? Does the statute require us to ask the question, why has he not come back to the United States?
Yes, it does.
Okay, and what are we supposed to look to answer that question? Well, obviously, if there's a public statement he's made about why he hasn't come back, that satisfies
right.
it. You might have that. Seems like you have that for the 98 issue.
Yes.
I'm not convinced that's completely relevant here. So what are we supposed to look to understand why he didn't come back to the United States with respect to the 2005?
Well, again, Your Honor, that's the very heart of the intent of the statute. If he were here and we were at the lower court, we could have asked him why he didn't come back to the United States. You can't ask a fugitive these questions because he's not answering. He won't even.
What do we look to answer that question in the absence of a person who can testify?
I think we look to the fact that warrants have been issued, that he's been put on notice, that there's mention of it in the media.
You're saying, so when you have all that information, we presume.
Right.
But it's a presumption, right? You were presuming that he's not coming back in order to avoid.
Right. Your Honor, I think we have to.
That's the best you can do, right?
Right. What would a reasonable person in this instance, how would that reasonable person react? If someone knew of all of this information, would a reasonable person not want to come back to the United States because they were a fugitive? And I think in that instance, yes. Unless they were so interested in their $7 million, which is why the Congress codified the statute.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Does Mr. Charbet have any time left? Okay, 1 minute, Mr. Charbet.
Judge Williams, let me answer your question. There was no travel patterns for Mr. Scott since 92. He never attempted to come back. He never did come back.
When was he last in the U.S.? We were talking from the record.
92.
92? He's been out of the U.S. since 92?
In the briefs, we articulate that. He left for Antigua. He started a business there.
It's different from question of...
He never came back, and I don't think the government quibbles with that.
Well, someone's shaking his head, not that it counts.
Now,
we'll find that in the record?
Yes. Either in the record or the argument.
Argument doesn't count for much.
Well, whatever record there is, Judge, I don't think that there's any question that Mr. Scott never attempted to come back. And let me address the specific intent of the statute, which the government, in its own brief on 19, says they have the burden. Let me quote, "The final necessary element under Section 246 requires the United States to show that the claimant, Mr. Scott or Solberry, deliberately avoided prosecution by purposely leaving the U.S. and declining to enter or reenter the U.S. or otherwise evading jurisdiction of a court in this case." That's specific intent. They've pointed to nothing other than the interview with the Canadian broadcasting system for the 98 complaint. And I agree with Judge Griffin, there's a statute of limitation issue on there. He was never indicted, and there's a 5-year statute, and we cited in our brief why the statute has run. One more quick thing.
Are you saying the warrant is not still good?
No, you got a 5-year statute, Judge. The warrant is attached to the complaint. Once that 5-year runs.
There's a question whether it's been told, though, right?
Right. And it hasn't been told because Mr. Scott never attempted to reenter it and never avoided prosecution, which is one of the reasons you would tell it. They knew where he was. They could have tried to extradite him. They didn't. That's a fact. One quick thing. My colleague states that Mr. Scott purposely.
How could they have extradited?
Antigua and the U.S. have an extradition treaty. And it doesn't matter whether you're a citizen of Antigua or not. They will extradite for crimes that are called dual criminality crimes, Your Honors. And Antigua doesn't recognize internet gaming as a dual criminality crime, so he would not have been extradited. But they do have a treaty, and the government never attempted to extradite him. One quick point.
Tell me again what your... I want to make sure I'm clear on what your due process argument is. In the Second Circuit in Colalis, invokes the notion that, there are presumptions. You don't appear. You forfeit, you waive your opportunity to make all the claims you say you haven't had the opportunity to make.
Well, we did appear. We appeared by counsel. Solberry is a corporation. We appeared by counsel, and the court didn't allow us to argue the merits. So I'm saying that Mr. Scott did appear through its counsel, and the court didn't allow us to attack the veracity or the legality of the criminal complaint on the jurisdiction venue issue and on the issue of whether there was a valid claim. So I think we did appear.
Whether the criminal charges could be proven? What are you saying now? Whether there was no viable criminal complaint, whether if tried it could not be made out, what is it that you were denied the opportunity to show?
To show that the criminal complaint, which was the basis for the initial seizure, and then the subsequent indictment were defective. We were ready to argue all those things. We weren't allowed. That's a merit argument.
Why?
Excuse me?
They were defective. Why? Apart from your venue? Is that part of what you're talking about?
Yes. We had 12 affirmative defenses, and if we were allowed to argue on the merits, we would have shown that both cases were defective for what the government, for example, the Patriot 981K. My colleague says that Mr. Scott purposely availed himself of the U.S. banking system. He did not. He was an Antiguan citizen. He was banking when an Antiguan bank and Royal Bank of Scotland in the island of Guernsey. What the U.S., they took the Patriot Act, 981K, and says, because you have an interbank account in New York with Harris Bank, we're going to take your money. I mean, that's a whole separate issue that we could have argued. And there was no funds in the interbank account, and the record that the government has, their complaint states that money was long gone. It was in a different account in stocks and bonds. It's like buying a house. It was converted into something else. That was a whole different argument, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Case is submitted.